Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Donaldson Files here and the Bachelor News Radio Network. Normally, Coco Costco would be joining us. I don't know if she's going to be able to make it or not. At the bottom of the hours, I do have a couple of people who will probably call in and just we're just old friends of the show and just shoot the bull and talk about what's going on. So basically, like I say, I know Coco ahead was taking her boyfriend to get his shot. I didn't know, I know she's going to try to make it on the show tonight. You know, that's my impression. Hopefully she does. I will also say she's kind of suffering herself from her own reactions to this. So, and as I say, at the bottom of the hour, we're going to probably just say at least have one, maybe two special guests of the show. Just call in to see what's going on. And I thought I would start here tonight. I just got finished working on some studies, and I thought I would kind of review them. They're kind of interesting studies, and so we're going to kind of look at those. We're going to look at some of the news stories that we got coming down, and we'll discuss on this show. Among those issues, let me put it this way. Let me see. You know, we're going to be covering a lot of stories. John Kerry. It appears that he may or may not have contacted the Iranians while during the Trump years, including talking about what the Israelis were doing. Not eating meat. We're going to ask the question, not eating meat and saving the planet. California, they have the recall. You know, what's going to happen? Most interesting story, minimum wage. We're going to do a story where McDonald's paid people $50 to show up for interviews. The fact is that, it's been really difficult for people to, for employees and employers to find good help. And I see this here in the Cedar Rapids, Iowa area, where literally people are looking at $10, $12, $13, $14 an hour already being asked. And you're seeing this across the country. There is a shortage of workers, especially at the lower end. You know, people are having a difficult time finding employees. You know, you would think that in an economy where you have millions of people unemployed, but certainly part of that is dealing with the stimulus package. So basically what I wanted to kind of do here tonight is, like I say, so we're going to get, like I say, we wanted to kind of touch base. I am going to kind of touch base with, like I say, some more interesting data tomorrow. Jennifer Cobera, maybe Justin Hart will be joining us. We're still working on the show. It's going to be an update of coronavirus, but I'll be kind of beginning with some of the data that I've been collecting. And then, as I say, at the bottom of the hour, we'll have some guests coming in. So, let me kind of begin this. As I said, we got a lot to cover here. And here's the first thing I'm going to start with. What I did recently, I looked at four sets of data. And what we did was compare red states, blue states, lockdown versus not lockdown states. It was more of a summary of things we have done in the past through the foundation. But what I did is I looked at four different ways of looking at this study. I just wanted to kind of touch base here on all of this. The one thing I wanted to see is I was looking at two things. The thing I was looking at is the economic side, unemployment side. You know, lockdown versus the less non-lockdown states. Also looking at, red states who tend to be less restrictive versus blue states, how we compare it with lockdown and with overall deaths from coronavirus. And I did measure everything by trying to do it by death, death by per capita. So, this is, like I say, kind of an important story. So here's the thing. The first study I did is, like, every week we do a running of the economic side and the updates on the deaths per state. Now, the most recent data I took, essentially, in states with, and this was states with Democratic governors versus Republican governors. And in 2020, there were 26 states with Republican governors, 24 states with Democratic governors. But that changed to 27 with the, in Montana, where a Republican took over for a Democrat. So here's the thing. There are 301,000 deaths in blue states versus red states, 263,000. Blue states average per state 600 deaths versus a little over 9,700 per state. On a per capita basis, Republicans or red states, the Republican governors had 1,604 per 1 million versus death versus 1,578, which is about 26,000 lives, deaths per 1 million. Then I looked at the overall unemployment numbers. On the average, in March, Democrats had 6.4% unemployment. Republican states had 4.6% unemployment. So it's about so basically what you had was 18,000 per 1 million more people in blue states, Democrat states, were unemployed. And so the question will come into play here. And in the fourth quarter, Republican states averaged 5.1% growth in the fourth quarter versus 3.7% in states with Democratic governors. Question comes into play is, how do you measure success? And the question that comes into play here is, we're talking 26 deaths per a million. And the price was slower economic growth and 18,000 people per 1 million unemployed, more unemployed. So let me kind of repeat talking about is, what we're talking about here is, you know, 18,000 per 1 million. And it kind of translates to, when I kind of put it in terms here, and this translates out to nearly 6 million people unemployed. Different, I mean, that, let's say if blue states had similar unemployment numbers to Republican states, we're looking at approximately 6 million less people unemployed if we had a similar across the board. Or you can say there's 6 million more people unemployed in states with Democratic governors. So the question that comes into play is that paid to stop the coronavirus. And you have to remember this. This doesn't count deaths from other causes. There have been at least one study that was done where they has estimated 3 million additional deaths or prematurely die over the next 20 years. So in effect, overall, to save, let's say, less than 600,000, we may end up killing more than double population, the number of people killed, maybe a 2-to-1 ratio. But I'm not even throwing that into the mix. I'm just simply looking at coronavirus. And with this particular study, when you're looking at 26 per 1 million, and you have to pay 18,000 unemployed as a result of that, is it worth? We're not talking a significant difference, maybe 3 to 5% differential within, you know, with differential. That's a high price to pay. You can decide for yourself, was that worth the price?
A boy born in Joplin, Missouri was fascinated by anything with wheels and a motor. The odds of him going on to fascinate millions with his talent? 1 in 260,000. The odds of this born racer having 157 career top 10 finishes in NASCAR? 1 in 125 billion. But every driver seeks the pinnacle of their achievements. The odds of him winning both the Daytona 500 and the Brickyard 400 in the same year? 1 in 195 million. The odds of a child being diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I'm NASCAR driver Jamie McMurray, and my niece has autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Yes, this is Tom Donis here on the Donaldson Files and the Bachelor News Radio Network. And don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to advertise on this show, here's what you need to do, labachelor40@gmail.com. That's right. Send an email. We want to talk about advertising on this show at labachelor40@gmail.com. And what this gets you is, very simply put, you can get the following. 3 ads. You can also get, you'll be listed as a sponsor for the hour. So if you want to become a sponsor, that's even better. Plus, you get an additional mention. So you're going to get as many as 6 mentions in the show. And this will be repeated on the podcast on the Bachelor News Radio Network. So labachelor40@gmail.com here on the Bachelor News Radio Network. Okay. Back to where I was at. All right. So here's the thing. Now, the interesting thing about, I mean, one of the things I did in this thing is I looked at 4 different scenarios to look at. And some scenarios you would have blue states slightly less deaths. Some scenarios, blue states slightly more deaths when you look at all the data. So in other words, I didn't necessarily look at it from a perspective, but the one thing that you're going to see is going to be very clear is that the economic side is consistent on the economic side, is consistent. The deaths per capita are very, there's no real statistical significance difference. And let's look at the other way. Okay, number 2. The second, we looked at the top 8 populous states. This is approximately 160 million Americans and 8 states, 4 with Democratic governors, 4 Republican governors. We're looking at Texas, Florida, Ohio, Georgia, whose population is about 74 million. We're looking at 4 populous states with Democratic governors, California, New York, Illinois, and Pennsylvania, which has about 85 million. When you look at the demographics, they're very similar. You know, 57% of the Democratic states had a white population, were white, 56 were white in Republican states. Blacks made up 21% in Democratic states, about 20% in GOP states. Republican states actually had a slightly higher, I take that back. Hispanics made up 21% in Democratic states, 20% in GOP states. Blacks had actually a slightly higher percentage of blacks at 15% versus 11%, and Asians made up about 8.5 to 3% with the favor going to Democratic states. All right. And again, you look at the total death total Democratic states had more deaths of coronavirus, 162,000 to 122,000. But here's the thing. On a per capita basis, Democratic states had a higher, and these four populist, and these eight populist states had a higher per capita deaths of 20, 30 deaths per million versus 1703 deaths for GOP states. So basically, slightly over 300 deaths per million. Now, interesting enough, while the overall general, and remember, at the first study, when we looked at all 50 states, there was a slight advantage for blue states. When you look at the bigger states, that disappears totally. The unemployment numbers were even were higher. Among the Republican states, it was 5.2%, which was higher than the national Republican average of 4.6. And in the Democratic side, it was 7.8% unemployment, which would be slightly higher than the 6.4% in March data. But the bottom line is now we're looking at something like 26,000 more people were unemployed in these particular states in contrast to the Republican side. And they had 300 and about 27 less deaths per million. And we got rid of it. Texas, Georgia, and Florida, for the most part, had an open strategy to the more restrictive states, where New York, Illinois, Pennsylvania, California were actually had more restrictive, were far more restrictive. And what you saw was less unemployment and lower growth because, again, the fourth quarter among the Republicans were very similar to the national average. Those four Republican states had a 4.1% growth, very similar to the national average, to about and so basically what you're seeing here is very simple. You had more economic growth, less unemployment, and you had a higher, and you still had less deaths in these more populous states. So you look at it, the top eight states, the bottom line is, the bottom line is that you actually had more, you had more deaths. Now, lockdown skeptics. Now, here's the interesting study. There was another study done. I want to kind of move to another study here. Let me see if I can get this one. I'm going to go with the divided GOP and Democratic before I go to lockdown. All right. In National Review Capital Matter, what they did, they looked at, now they just looked at the economic side. They didn't look at the coronavirus side, which I added to it. But essentially what they found was the following. States either with Democratic governors and Republican control of one or two legislature or reverse, Republican governors with a Democratic hold of one or two of the legislators, the Republicans had an average of March of 4.7%. We're talking about states that are strictly Republican legislature governor, and divided states were like 5.3%. Republican governors running divided government was about 5.6%. Democratic governors of divided states, 5.2%. All of this under the national average. Democrats data had 7% unemployment. Contrast to the other two states. In other words, just as we've seen in every other study, we've saw very clearly that Democratic states paled in comparison to Republican states in economics. And average was deaths per capita was, 116.44 deaths per million in Republican states. Democratic states had 15.67, so approximately 77 million per million. 16 deaths per million with a lower unemployment. And what we found is that GOP states had 35% less unemployment than the Democratic states and 5% more in deaths per capita, very similar to the first study. Interesting enough, they had 15% less unemployment compared to divided states, but slightly higher death total per capita. And the divided states themselves had less deaths and less unemployment. So a blue state, definitely. So what can we conclude here? Well, and again, these numbers don't show the increase in deaths from suicides, drug overdose delayed or no treatments for chronic diseases, increases in mental health issues, nor does it measure the loss of educational opportunities as many states were closed for school instructions. And so you get, you know, would the difference in deaths from red states versus blue states for the coronavirus be there, you'll be wiped out from if you threw this in there? You know, the possibility does in fact exist there. But there's no doubt that the unemployment side favored the red states. And again, here's the price, 25,000 more unemployed per million in red states versus blues. I mean, less 25,000 less unemployed in red states versus blue states. And the question is, was this worth the price for that, for an extra 5% reduction in deaths? And remembering, as I stated earlier, we aren't counting excess deaths to other causes. So that comes into play here as well. So what we're talking, you know, so what we're looking at here is we got three studies seeing basically when you combine all of the numbers, there's really no statistical significant difference in deaths per capita between Republican and Democratic states. But there's certainly a significant difference between unemployment and economic growth and prosperity between Republican and Democratic states. In other words, were less likely to see economic growth. They were more likely to see but they were not more likely to see. I mean, in other words, there was no significant deaths when you put in all of this study together. And so this, comes into play here. It's important to understand because there's a price to be paid. We, in the economic side of the world, you use the word one other trade-offs. Was the trade-off worth an additional 4 to 6 million people unemployed to say possibly a 1%, 2%, or even 0% deaths per capita? You can't even make the case. And we're going to do lockdowns here very shortly after this. And one of our guests has called in, and we will get back with her as well. This is Tom Donaldson here on the Donaldson Files and the Bachelor News Radio Network.
You might know me. I'm 50 Cent. You may follow my tweets, my Facebook friends. Odds are a few in a 6 degrees separate us. We're that close. What's crazy is 1 in 6 don't know where their next meal is coming from. These are your coworkers, your neighbors, your friends. Hunger's too close for us to ignore. So visit feedingamerica.org/hunger and find your local food bank to see how you can make a difference. From one close friend to another, let's do this. I'm 50 Cent, and together we are Feeding America.
A message from Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, here back to Donaldson Files and the Bachelor News Radio Network. And don't forget, if you want a chance to advertise on this show, what you need to do is labachelor40@gmail.com. Send an email. We'll send out the sales team. Three ads. You get to be listed as a sponsor of the show. and you get one mention in the show. So you get six opportunities to have your name brought out if you go for the big package of being a sponsor of the show. It's a bargain, and we'll make it, and we'll work it so it works to your advantage. So this is Tom Donaldson here of the Donaldson Files and the Bachelor News Radio Network. Joining me on the line is our good friend, the Swamp Girl, Pam. How you doing, Pam?
I'm doing pretty good tonight, Tom. How you doing?
Not too bad, not too bad. And, well, like I said, I want to finish this. Then there's a few things we're going to get into because we got the John Kerry story, Board of Disasters. I got a story here, minimum wage in McDonald's, where literally McDonald's is paying people, and I think it's in Florida, and we'll get to the story, $50 just to show up for the interview. You know, even if you don't get the job, you get $50. And we're going to answer the question, what killed more people than the coronavirus in San Francisco? There's a question we will ask that question as well. And then there's John Kerry, who got caught, I guess according to a leaked story, that he may have been tattling about Israel to the Iranians in secret meetings when he wasn't even a government official, but a private citizen having conversations with the Iranian government. And so that is an interesting story. So we got all of this. And then I want to ask you the big question. Are you willing to eat one hamburger a month to save the planet?
No.
Yeah, well, like I said, we'll go more into that. But I thought, you know, we'll go more into that. So, okay, well, here's the thing. Here's the thing I'm going to bring up here. I'm reviewing this series of studies that I conducted. I just got finished doing. And what I did is, I kind of looked at, okay, different ways. For example, divided government, what we would say, when you have Republicans and Democrats, you're having control of the governor's seat and legislature mixed. Then you have strictly GOP where they control everything, and Democratic states where they, control everything. And so far, basically, the point I made is that I looked at it in three ways, divided government. We also did one where I just simply compared Republican versus Democratic governors in the top eight states, most populous states, and then all 50 states. And I find it fascinating that the bigger the state is, I mean, I say when you put everything together, there is no real significant death, but you're basically looking anywhere between 18 to about 25,000 per million people unemployed. Now, the lockdown states, and interesting enough, there are about 13 states that did not lock, or 11 states that did not lock down. One of them is your South Carolina during the winter months when we had the surge.
Gotcha.
And interesting, all of these states happen to be Republican. The average death total per million, 1,571 per million, in the non-lockdown states. So those states that didn't re-lock down their economy in the winter, like South Carolina, average 1,671. Those states that locked down average 1,736 per million. And not only that, but you look at the top, let's see, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. The nine worst states were all lockdown states. Seven out of those nine states had Democratic governors. And one was a total red state with, total control, which was Mississippi. And one was a Republican state with a Democratic legislature with Massachusetts, Republican governor, Democratic legislature. Here's the interesting thing. 4.3% unemployment in those non-lockdown states. Lockdown states had 5.8%. And this is, again, interesting. This follows data we had done previously to the foundation. And my point I'm going to make to this audience is, is we got two, we got four, these are four studies, lockdown versus non-lockdown states, Republican versus Democratic states, and how you measure it. And on the average, there's no significant difference in deaths per, you know, per capita on coronavirus. But you're seeing anywhere between 15,000 to approximately 25,000 per a million more people unemployed in blue states. And you had, like, in the fourth quarter, about a 20% slower economic growth. I don't know. Sounds like to me the lockdowns weren't a great, were not a great success. What do you think?
Well, I'd have to go Coco on you with this one. What were the rates prior to the coronavirus, number one? Number two, the population. Number three, the climate. You know, I understand that this is just my general view, is that places that have more population and colder climates, more people stayed in, stayed together, and were closer together. You know, here, I'm standing and talking to you in my backyard, and there is nobody around. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's also the weather. You know, that's where I'd have to go Coco on you with I can understand what you're saying, and I understand how you're doing that with Republican and Democratic states, but you also have to look at the population, the health care coverage. You know, they were doing experimental stuff here when COVID first started with the blood transfusion stuff here that wasn't being tried elsewhere. Elsewhere they were trying medications and this and that. Some of those variables, but when you're talking about the unemployment rates and stuff, to me it depends on how, you know, in your Democratic states, it seems to me that they take, you know, they are the let me take care of you and tell you what to do type of state. We talked about unions the last time. Here we've got the right to work stuff, you know, going on. You know, I don't know how many of those variables are in those stats you gave out. You see what I'm saying? I would add on as many variables as I could to that. But looking at it overall, I see exactly what you're saying.
I know what you're saying. But here's the thing I would look at is that, that's the reason why I did the things. I mean, first of all, we did have a research which we put those variables in, and that was like during the fall. And we found similar, we found the same thing. So we did that. Now, in this particular case, again, I didn't do all the variables like Wilf or Riley did for us at the winter. But what I did do, but let's look. I mean, here's the thing. That's the reason why, you know, I did a separate study in just the most populous states, the top eight populous states, you know, four Republicans, four Democrats.
Gotcha.
And basically, they have densely populated cities. And from a racial perspective, I mean, from a demographic, there were very similarities. They were similar in whites. They were similar in number of Hispanics. They were very similar. In fact, Republicans had slightly more black population than the Democrats of those top eight states. And the Republicans had slightly more Asians than, let's say. And so I understand exactly what you're saying. And then when we looked at the non-lockdown states, this includes some very good-sized states. Utah, Florida, Texas. And so, and so I know exactly what you're saying. You're making a very good point. And certainly, you know, one could do, let's say, we could delve more into that data, you know, into those variables.
Many do you have? I'm going to throw it out there if you don't. How many have higher immigration? Population too, because that community around here seems to be the one that got the message last, in my opinion, because I live in a very integrated community here, and the message wasn't presented to them to where, you know, they were concerned about that much. And then you've got the cultural issues, which you and I have talked about several times, you know. Where you have units, you don't just have mom and dad and a kid. You've got, you know, entire units of family. As culturally, I have to go cocoa on you on some of that stuff.
That's a good point. I mean, you're making a good point. I mean, but here's the thing. Okay, among the Republican states, here's who you got. You got Texas, which has got high immigration. Florida, it's got high Hispanic, but I'm not sure. Their Hispanic mix is different than any other country. Georgia has got an increased number of immigrants coming in. New York, and, okay, Illinois, again, now Illinois is also, does have high, Chicago is like the number one. It's like in the top five states of Hispanics.
Oh.
And as a state, they had 18% of their population Hispanic, very similar to New York. Obviously, California and Texas are both high Hispanic populations. Both are border states.
I'm wondering if that's going to change. Like you talk about South Carolina, I'm wondering if, and this is what I've been kind of sort of, me and my little quirky brain has been going, we have a migrant population that comes in and does farming. I mean, it's seasonal. And, those people come in and they get their permits to come in and work the farms and stuff, and that's always been the case. And I'm just wondering, how well did the word get out that there's a bad disease here? You know what I mean?
What you mean is, how many of the migrant workers spread the coronavirus in South Carolina or some of these other states that they come in?
My concern is how many are perishing because of that, because they didn't know. You've got people, you might have, nine people in one bunkhouse, Like I said, it's seasonal, and they go and they work the different places. And each year everybody's looking forward to them coming back, And,
Well, I guess, the answer question, obviously, I did not necessarily, look into, immigration status as far as that goes. But if I look at, the overall numbers, again, you say, when I'm looking at comparisons here, there are, you got Texas. You got Florida, which has a high Hispanic population. You have Georgia, which has got an increasing number of Hispanics coming into the state. Ohio, Pennsylvania, two of the states that's aside of this, are states with smaller population of Hispanics. They don't have the same immigration that you see in the other states that I just mentioned. So I tried to even that out as much as possible with that, with those numbers. So.
I understand what you're saying. I've read your research and stuff on it, and I agree with it totally. You lock people down, and they're going to get sick. Sorry, but this is the way it is. The mask mandates and things like that didn't seem to face this disease whatsoever.
Here's the other thing. Here's the other thing, too, that comes in place, I'm going to take a quick break because there's another point I want to bring up. And I kind of want to get your points on this. Here on the Bachelor News Radio Network, I got Pam the Swamp Girl joining me. Don't forget tomorrow, Jennifer Cabrera, possibly Justin Hart is going to be joining us. These two people are two of the data analysis experts on coronavirus. So we're going to ask a whole lot of questions to them, and hopefully they'll have us an answer.
I think that would be a little bit better than me, right?
Well, actually, better than me. I mean, these people know. These people know the numbers. Justin Hart's
I'll be listening to that.
He's a geek. Have you ever heard of show? What I thought. So hold on just a second. It's Tom Donaldson, Bachelor News Radio Network.
Go, Caleb!
Come on, hit a homer, Jesse!
Let's go, guys!
Hey, did you guys know that kids who play sports earn more money when they grow up?
Of course. I knew that.
Hey, did you guys know that kids who read books have a bigger vocabulary?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Wow, jinx. Did you guys know that friendly children have more friends?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's true. I knew that. Did you guys know that winter babies are better at music?
Everyone knows that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, pretty obvious.
Yeah,
yeah.
So
yeah.
Obvious. Oh, hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
Huh. I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure I knew that.
I'm pretty sure you didn't.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected.
Since Buffalo Wild Wings is always open late, here are a few things you'll enjoy. Buzzer beaters, wings in 21 signature sauces and seasonings, and great deals on food and beer. Grab select domestic draft beers starting at $4. $4 shareables like street tacos, fried pickles, chili queso dip, mozzarella sticks, and roasted garlic mushrooms, and deals on select liquor and house cocktails. Phew, that's a mouthful. Catch all of the late night action. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Offers and participation vary. Please drink responsibly. Void where prohibited.
Yeah, this is Tom Dallas here in Dawson Pop. If you want to comment here in the last 18 minutes with and joined Pam, the Swamp Girl, myself, feel free to call in 646-929-0130, 646-929-0130. And don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, we do have some other great programming on the Bachelor News Radio Network. Don't forget the Bachelor News Radio Show with L.A. Bachelor as your host. He talks about issues of race, politics, policing, injustice, inequality, religion, sports. They affect brown, black, and poor people negatively. Every Monday and Thursday on this network, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at blocktalkradio.com/LA-Bachelor. And don't forget, you can also get this show on the Bachelor News Radio Network, and You're the Law, which will follow this particular show every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So just it is another great show, and they have some great guests, and we got two of the sharpest criminal minds, Keith Humphrey and Virgil Green. All right. Now, okay. Here's an interesting tidbit here, because one of the things I did is, okay, the COVID tracking, which was associated with Atlantic Magazine, you know, they just kind of wrapped everything up. But their most recent data, I'm looking at, like, blacks and Hispanics per 100,000, okay? And the three worst states, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, for blacks, and for Hispanics, New York and New Jersey, followed by followed by Arizona. Now, okay, so, and again, I kind of did, and one of the things I did, and by the way, we did a study on this with all the two of the variables last fall. One of the things we looked at, we found what I'm about to say here, that blacks and Hispanics were more likely to die in states with Democratic governors than Republican governors when we looked at it. But here's some of the numbers. I mean, if you want to put it in this capacity, is this. If you live in New York, if you're black, 352 per 100,000 died of the coronavirus. Hispanics was 252 per 100,000. Florida, which is everybody's demon, had 150 blacks per 100,000, 137 per 100,000 Hispanics. So in other words, you are twice as likely to die under Andrew Cuomo than Ron DeSantis. And again, I didn't do all the variables that you're looking at. But I'm,
well,
you know,
is that count being thrown into the nursing home?
Well, obviously that would be counted out. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So I mean, that's
in New York.
I mean, yeah. Well, you know, like I said, and so I mean, there's a lot of ways to look at these numbers. But I mean, here's the thing: again, I took the top four populous states. They're similar in demographics, similar numbers, basically. New York, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and California average about 167 deaths per 100,000 for Hispanics, 227 deaths for 100,000 for blacks. Florida, I mean, when you look at Florida, Texas, Georgia, Ohio, those are the four most populous states. That number was 152 per 100,000 and 119 per 100,000. All right. Your South Carolina is 179 per 100,000, which basically means New York, Illinois, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Michigan ranks far ahead of them. So if you're a black living in South Carolina, you're safer being a black living in South Carolina for coronavirus than you are in New York, in Illinois, in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Michigan. So that, I mean, those are the numbers. I mean, and like I said, we're going to really delve into those tomorrow night as well. But I do want to get you.
Yeah, but, you know, I can argue with you again on that as far as it might be cultural.
Go ahead.
Because despite what people are, despite what the news is, if you really look at South Carolina and the people here, it's like you take care of your neighbors. You don't care what color they are. You don't care what language they speak. Our little neighborhood communities are like that. Now, there are some that are elite. I am not going to tell you that. And there's some parts of the state that are elite.
Yes.
However, on the whole, on the cultural level, you take care of your neighbors and stuff, and people look out for each other, I think, despite, like I said, skin color or even language barriers. You know, everybody's gets people to the doctors and tries to help people out here. I think that that's something that I like about this state in particular. Now, we have some Democratic mayors here that lock their cities down and stuff. And people raise cane and stuff. But on the whole, I think people look out for each other here, whereas I've noticed in some of the big cities, people don't even know who their neighbor is.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, there's a, yeah, I say that may be about, you know, that certainly is a valid point, and certainly in the case of South Carolina, I mean, you don't have, let's say, I mean, I think, what's it, Greenville or is it Columbia, the largest city population-wise?
Oh, man, I couldn't tell you that right now. Greenville's been growing and growing and growing and growing up there.
Yeah.
And we call it the upstate area because you got Greenville, Spartanburg, you got Clemson University, Pickens, you got Anderson. They're all there right straight on 85. And that whole place is booming up there. When I say booming, I'm talking about building, housing and things like that. Whereas the older populations are in the Midlands and the lower country. The beaches after Hugo did a big, huge, you know, land boom. And you've got, you know, different people coming in down there. But on the whole, what I call the meat and taters of South Carolina, and it's not uncommon for people to say, where are you from? You know, here. It's just not uncommon for that. And I think that's one of the things I like about this. And I'm a small girl using a small neighborhood situation.
Yeah.
I know what's going on two blocks away from me. People walk, and you talk about being outside. You walk and you know what's going on with your neighbors. You know who's sick, who's not sick, who needs help, who doesn't need help. This person might need this. This person might need that. And that's the way we handled the COVID. I was the person going to the store getting groceries like five houses, you know. And that's something you just do. Whereas I was the one person going out and everybody was staying in. You know, we did have a lockdown for, 14 days? We did have the 14-day lockdown. But it wasn't really a lockdown. You could still go to the store and you could go to the, you know, wherever you needed to go.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I understand what you're saying. And, again, I mean, it's certainly – you can make that reflective in the case of South Carolina versus these other states with their
numbers. The governor here also said that it's, you know, he believes in free will.
Yeah.
He stood up and said that. You know, people think we ain't got much sense and smarts, talk slow and walk slow. People kind of know what to do. You know.
Well, like I said,
give us the information and we'll handle it.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And like I said, the point I made is earlier is that, you know, in the case of South Carolina, you don't have the major, but in the case when you look at comparing, let's say, a state like Florida, Texas, Georgia, or New York, Pennsylvania, these are states that do have very high densely population, or cities of high densely population. So they're very similar in comparison in that regard. Okay. We got about 8 minutes left, and I do want to really get into this. There are several other points I wanted to kind of make in there real quick here.
He had some other topics that were kind of interesting.
Yeah, here's the topic. Here we go. All right. Bill Gates wants you to avoid eating beef and switch to synthetic meat to fight climate change. So I think you already gave your answer, but I want you to go ahead and give me your answer one more time. You know, are you going to be a non-meat eater and eat,
Tom,
are you going to eat the fake meat?
Just let me get real on you on that. How much methane do you want to come out the other end of me to contribute to global warming? That's the question that needs to be asked.
Yeah, so what you're saying
I don't know if anybody's ever had a veggie burger, but that's enough damage in itself to crack the ozone. You
okay.
see what I'm
well,
saying?
That,
I mean,
well,
that's
that,
the deal. So, I don't want to give up my cow meat or my Bambi burgers or anything like that that I've been eating, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
We eat Bambi burgers, so.
Yeah. I mean, like I say, I'm one of those that say, what's the old saying? I'm going to eat my hamburger. I mean, somehow or another.
Yeah,
I imagine there's some synthetic beef that tastes good. But
no, Tom, there is not. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, then that takes care of that, yeah. But I have to say, there's nothing to me that's as good as a nice ribeye.
And how is that
nice going to
save the environment, Dave? I mean, how is it?
Well,
you trade a cow fart for a people fart? I mean, come on.
Yeah, essentially, they're basically saying, in effect, cows give methane to keep cows on a farm is very energy intensive, blah, 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 blah.
Well, let me ask about this. What are they going to do about the farting ponds? We have farting rivers and farting ponds. We have swamps here. We have methane. Methane comes up out of water from dead vegetation and stuff. Has anybody gone? It's called swamp gas. It's methane.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody goes there with that, you know?
Yeah.
So, I'm still eating the meat. I'm too old, too tired.
Yeah. All right. Well, okay, here's the, like I say, an interesting story here. Florida McDonald's, they are so desperate to get people to work for them that they will pay you $50 just to show up for the interview. It's kind of an interesting situation to me because you're in a situation right now where literally a lot of these stores and a lot of these franchises, restaurants, franchises, stores are looking for workers. They're literally looking. You drive around Cedar Rapids and there are signs saying $12 an hour. Starting $12 an hour. And in Florida, you're looking at as many as $13 an hour. You're almost getting to that $15 an hour And so this guy basically, they were basically saying, okay, we're paying $50 just to show up for an interview. And he still is looking for applicants.
I think a business has any right to do that if they want to. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But it's interesting to me that because I've talked to people when you have these stimuluses and money floating around all over the place, You know, and I saw this in the last summer, you know, when I talked to restaurant managers last summer, and they would tell you, you know, those people getting that extra $600 per week. You know, I had one manager say, I can't get these people back to work. I literally have 25, 30 openings. There are people, let's say,
to this
that
day
I.
Today is still cheaper to stay home and collect unemployment. Yeah. I mean, to the day as we speak.
Yeah,
yeah it's, it
and,
is.
And it's kind of an interesting paradigm because here's one side of the equation. You can literally make your almost your minimal, you know, you're going to make $13 an hour, $12 to $13 an hour.
The other side of that is nobody has told these people, all right, if you do not want to go to work, that small business will close. Then where are you going to go get your burger? People do not understand that part of the equation as far as keeping their local economies going. They don't care.
And you
can't afford the gas to get that, you know, that money will not afford you the gas to go to the next county who might have a McDonald's or whatever, a burger or whatever, you know, drive whatever. You see what I'm saying? Because of the same situation. If you don't have the businesses, then your money's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah. Well, like I said, the point to me is I think it was an interesting story because I was intrigued by the idea that you got businesses so desperate for workers that they're willing to pay you just to show up and be interviewed. Here's $50. Now let me talk to you. They're paying you to come interview. And it's just, we're living in a country. I mean, look, I mean, the unemployment in Florida is 4.7%, point higher than it was last year at this time. So, it's not, you know, even in states like Florida where you have a lower unemployment, it's still higher than what it was last year. So you still have a lot of workers out there that are not working. And you got to say to yourself, okay, you know, what do you do to get these people back in the job market? Obviously, there's that disconnect, as you stated, you know, with the various stimulus out there. You know, there are enough people who are probably earning as much not working than working. And I guess it's the law.
On the other side of the equation, though, if you think about it, big corporations do that. When they look for applicants and stuff, they will fly people in for an interview and put them up in a hotel for an interview.
Yeah.
And we're talking about major bucks, but it's still
point.
A similar thing where you're paying for somebody to come interview for your company. You know,
I'm going to stop you right there, Pam, because I want to thank you very much because we're right at the end of time. Thank you, the Swamp Girl, for coming on the show. Unfortunately, Coco was not able to make it in. She kind of texted me that the appointment with her boyfriend to get his vaccine ran a little bit late. So hopefully next Tuesday she'll be joining us. This is Tom Donaldson on the Bachelor News Radio Network saying good night.
Welcome, everyone, to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network. We're glad that everybody is able to tune in and join us for another edition of the You and the Law podcast show. And we want to, if you're a first-time listener, we want to remind you that the call-in number to the show is 646-929-0130. That's 646-929-0130. And if you have a comment or a question, the producer will ask if you want to come on and talk with us. If not, you can just leave your comments in the chat room, and we'll definitely get those comments, and we'll answer those comments on air. Or if you'd like to come on the air and talk with us, please do so. We're always glad to listen, always glad to have our listeners come on the air and talk with us. So, but we want to remind you that if you are on social media, if you want to follow You and the Law podcast show, you can follow us on Facebook. That's at You and the Law One. That's You and the Law One. And you can follow us on Instagram at @you_andthelaw. And you can also follow us on Twitter at @youthelaw1. That's @youthelaw1 on Twitter. And so today we've got an exciting show to talk with our listeners about. It's definitely a topic that really needs to be talked about, especially it's dealing with our young youth and how they are being traumatized when they're coming into contact with law enforcement, and what is the long-term mental effects that will have on our youth in the community. And so it's a topic that me and my co-host, Chief Humphrey, felt it was much needed to have because of everything that's been going on between the minority community and law enforcement. Oftentimes we don't talk about those mental health issues that our young children are seeing and dealing with, and they may not have the outlet to express their views and their opinions, especially of what they are seeing that's going on in their community. So just looking forward to having that conversation with my co-host, who goes by the name of Chief Swag, and he's going to be tuning in and joining us. But, you know, I couldn't do the show without you, brother, man. You know, you play a significant role, and your part is being the co-host. So you should feel real honored.
You're going to get this right one day. I am the host, okay? I'm not a co-host. You're the co-host. I'm the host. And I make the show.
Oh, you make it
right there. What's going on, brother? How you doing? You doing all right?
I'm doing good, sir. I'm doing good, man. Glad to hear your voice, man, and glad we can come on and talk with our listeners about things that's going on around the world, around the United States, with law enforcement and in the minority community.
Yeah, man, I think these are topics that we can't talk about enough. And you know, I just go back to my childhood and the relationship the relationships that were not positive in the community that I grew up between police and the kids in the community. As a matter of fact, kids were scared of police, and did they have a right to be? Well, yeah, based on what they saw. There was not anything that was discussing about the positive and proactive things that law enforcement were doing in the community. They had events. They had the PAL program, but in the community that I grew up, that was non-existent. It was go from call to call to call, be reactive, put people in jail, be more aggressive in that community. And that's what a lot of kids have ingrained that I grew up with. They had ingrained in their minds when it comes to an image of police.
Yeah, you're right, Keith. And you know, oftentimes we hear parents who will tell children when they see a police officer, if you do something bad, he's going to handcuff you and he's going to take you to jail.
Man, that just goes through me when I hear that, man.
Yeah. And I think some parents, they seem to think that that's just a way to kind of, you know, I don't know, frighten a kid, but I know I never did it to my kids. But and I often tell parents that that's just not a way to really, because we don't want them to fear the police. And when you explain that to the parents and to the child, they walk away with a different perspective about using that comment that that, you know, hey, if you get in trouble, they're going to put the handcuffs on you. And so it's not something that we would encourage parents to even express that with their kids, because of everything that's going on with police. And unfortunately, you know, Keith, we're dealing with another officer-involved shooting in North Carolina, and just today, the FBI has opened up a civil rights probe into the shooting, and it just appears that there's not a lot of transparency that's going on with the shooting that occurred in North Carolina, and that the fact that there are a lot of questions, and the police are not really releasing a lot of information. I think they've only released a short video to the family to see, and everything that I'm seeing, I don't know what you've seen, but it appears that the family has talked about the shooting more than the local law enforcement has talked about the shooting.
Well, you know what, Birds? I found that interesting, because I know one of the things that people were talking about was the release of the video. And I guess in North Carolina, this is just what I've heard, I don't know for a fact, I guess in North Carolina, you have to get approval, the department has to get approval from either the state attorney or the local attorney, from a judge, mm-hmm. yes, to release that. I've never heard of such thing. I've never heard anything like that in my life. And so,
yeah, me
so
neither.
You can't blame the local authorities, because they've got to follow those rules. But I don't understand how that, if you're talking about transparency and not on a part of that organization, I'm just talking about, if you're talking about being transparent, why do you have to ask a judge to give you permission to release body camera from footage that was paid for by tax dollars? I don't get that. I don't understand that. You know, maybe it's just that it's not for me to understand, but that does not make sense to me.
Well, Keith, and I think one of the things that a lot of people are really having a hard time understanding, yeah, okay, there is a state law that says that any law enforcement has to get the permission from a judge or a prosecutor to release that information. It would appear that the sooner you're able to release this, the sooner you're able to address what happened, and the public doesn't walk away with their own perception of what happened. And now the attorneys of this man's family, they are sharing a lot more with the public than local law enforcement are. But Keith, we're coming up on taking our first break. We're going to take this break, and we come back, we're going to be getting into the topic of the show, why black children are traumatized by police encounters. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
We're back with shocking newly released body camera video showing a disturbing encounter between Maryland police and a 5-year-old boy they put in handcuffs. Kathy Park reports.
Don't make me take you over there.
Your record of that text, y'all.
Okay.
Tonight, growing outrage in Maryland over this newly released body camera footage.
Cut it now.
Two Montgomery County police officers responded to a call to bring back a 5-year-old student who left school after he allegedly broke a computer.
Get in. Now. I'm not asking. Get in the car. I don't want to hear it.
After the officers bring him back, the situation quickly escalated. Police blur the identity of the child. Meanwhile, the yelling and berating is all caught on camera.
I mean, how do you learn that type of behavior at 5?
That's why people need to beat their kids.
Sit down.
When the boy doesn't stop crying, one officer screams just inches from his face. Police release a near hour-long video Friday near the end of the footage with his mom in the same room. An officer places handcuffs on the boy's wrist.
These are handcuffs. You know
what
they're
for? You want to go with Uncle Berto West?
Huh?
Huh?
You know what these are for? These are for people that don't want to listen and don't know how to act.
The incident took place January of last year. After an internal investigation, Montgomery County Police said both officers remain on the job. The boy's mother has since filed a lawsuit seeking justice and compensation for his trauma. In a statement, the school district wrote in part, "Our heart aches for this student. There is no excuse for adults to ever speak to or threaten a child in this way." Councilmember Will Jawando pushed to get the video released and demands a full investigation.
You shouldn't treat a human being the way this young boy was treated. It doesn't matter if he's 5 years old or 50 years old. No one should have been talked to in that manner.
And ultimately, what do you want to see happen to those two officers?
They should be fired.
Kathy Park, NBC News.
Welcome back to the UN Law broadcast here on the Vassar News Radio show on the Vassar News Radio Network at WCON in Chapel Hill. I want to remind people, if you are on the line or if you're listening online, you can ask questions in the chat room or you can ask at 646-929-0130. If you miss any part of this broadcast, go to their page on our website, the thebachelornewsradionetwork.com, and go right at the top of this, of the page from left to right. You'll see UN Law, their show page, and you can listen and enjoy all the information that they always give on a weekly basis. Guys, one point and then one sort of comment. Yes, North Carolina, they will not allow those cameras, that footage to be seen. You got to go through the court and the judge and all that kind of. But Carolina, quite candidly, I'm living here. I'm from Connecticut. You know, I'm from up top. So I don't really, you know, Carolina's backwards. It's always been. That's me speaking, law enforcement and otherwise. So I'm not surprised with that. I'm also not surprised that this man had his hands on the steering wheel. According to the autopsy, thank you, Virgil, for sending that to me. So he was shot in the head, the deadly blow, unarmed, everything. So, you know, unfortunately, we're not surprised by that. My question, I guess, now is, you know, when is the conversation going to go to where it's going to be about, for me, is immunity, it's this fraternal order of police that's stopping people. I mean, in terms of stopping what you guys try to do and what you're showing, bringing these discussions to bear. And the fact that when you look at the voting, it really comes down. I think you both said that on the show, on my show. People have to know who they're voting for. If this deputy sheriff or this police officer or this police chief has a certain kind of angry mindset, a kind of lack of humanity mindset, then you shouldn't vote for him. And that's the responsibility of us to make sure we're doing that, guys. I didn't mean to talk so long, but your thoughts.
Well, LA, yeah, let me say, Virgil, if you don't mind, let me take this.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Virgil. You know, LA, I tell you what I've seen. Not everybody can stand in front of a microphone and show empathy. Not everybody. Either, no matter what the circumstances are, whether it was a justified shooting or not unjustified shooting, questionable shooting, that police chief, that sheriff, or whomever has to show empathy and impartiality. Everyone can't do that. It's automatic go into, I need to defend my people, because if I don't defend my people, then the department and the members will be mad at me. Empathy, there shouldn't be no apology for being empathetic. Number one, that's just basic common sense. You can read all the books you want to on leadership, but if you don't have any common sense, that's not going to be, you're just going to be an educated fool, bottom line. The third thing is, the good thing that I've noticed out of this administration is that they're basically saying, we're not going to get rid of federal oversight when it comes to law enforcement agencies. As you see, they're going back and they're looking at Chauvin's history. They're looking at the Louisville Police Department. So there is hope out there. The problem is the resources are in place, L.A., and to the listeners, it's in place. The protocols are in place. The policies are in place. The laws are in place. It's the bottom line of who's enforcing it. Who's enforcing it? And I've got to take this break real quick, but you guys go right ahead. I'll be right back.
Okay. All right. And I want to, you know, add to that before we get into the topic of the show about what has occurred in what's going on in North Carolina is that, you know, since this incident has happened, there's been over six nights of protesting going on in Elizabeth City. And this was just days after the Minneapolis police officer who was convicted of murdering George Floyd. So there's been this spotlight put on police violence against black people. And now you've got another incident that has put the spotlight, and the spotlight has not been taken off of law enforcement. But another concern that's going on with the protesters and demonstrators in this particular city, Elizabeth City in North Carolina, is that you've got people that are doing peaceful protesting. They are frustrated. They are blocking off intersections, which is forcing motorists to take detours, to go different routes. But what that has caused is that you've got individuals who are probably living in a state that may have weapons in their vehicle. Now, all of a sudden, if this person is being prevented from going down a certain road, then that person may display a weapon. And that actually has happened, guys, where a gentleman pulled out a gun out of his dashboard. He never really pointed it at the protesters, but this was an incident. Now, that could have led to another shooting. So, you know, one of the things that I would like to say is that the law enforcement industry really needs to take a good look at everything that's going on in the United States, and the fact that every time we do something, or every time there's something done by a law enforcement officer, there's these multiple reactions from the community behind it, but it starts with what happens with the actions of either a police officer or a sheriff deputy. But I think there's been a video that's been released, Keith, that shows a truck. It looked like a sheriff deputy's truck with multiple deputies inside of the bed of this pickup who were approaching this gentleman. So there's a lot of questions as to how this incident went down, what led up to the shooting, and the fact that, according to information that has come out, this gentleman was not armed. He had his hands on a steering wheel. So hopefully this department will be just as transparent and do some things to really calm down some of the tension that's going on in this city. Because, Keith, as you know, the tension that's going on in Elizabeth City can carry over into other communities in other cities in North Carolina and outside of North Carolina.
Chief Green, if I could just say this to you both, this is why when I had you guys on my show, when we talked about justice for George Floyd and this officer being arrested, I said two things. Let's see how much time he gets, number one. Number two, there was an incident right after, 20 minutes after the verdict. Now you have this young man, Mr. Brown, in Elizabeth City getting shot. People are very cynical. Enough is enough. And black folks especially buy into the Kool-Aid of, oh, okay, justice, you know, it's going to get better. Like we had the first black president, this, that, and the other. And it never does. It doesn't seem like getting that. And people are sick and tired of being sick and tired. The ones like us that see it for what it is and understand it, guys, so it's a frustrating, cynical, pessimistic outlook that me and a lot of people have as black and brown people, that George Floyd, he ain't even, I mean, the verdict came out, but the sentencing is not till June. And now you got another one where this guy was just shot in his car. Like, enough is enough already, guys. People don't seem to understand it.
Well, I think they do, LA. I think people understand, and I think law enforcement understands also, and it's very frustrating for, especially me as a chief, me especially a man of color. It's very disappointing because I my favorite term we've used is you take a 1 mile step, you walk a mile, you get knocked back 20 miles, and incident, and it doesn't even matter if it's a justified incident. The fact of the matter is, this is what people are seeing, especially this is what people of color are seeing. They're seeing police officers, white police officers, having to use excessive force, up to deadly force on someone. Now, I will tell you this, that's not reality in the world. That's not happening every day. That's not happening in every city. That's not. You see good officers, there are good officers out here. And I've told, but it comes down to the point of when you have an incident like Derek Chauvin, you have an incident like the young lady who shot Dante, Dante with the gun, thinking it was a taser. That's inexcusable. That's unnecessary. And we can't make excuses for that. You don't make those kind of mistakes. But those type of mistakes override the good things that officers are doing out here. And that's hard to recover. That's hard to recover from when you see this over and over and again. And when you literally count the names and you see the faces and all the faces look like you, and then all the other faces are non-black, that does send a wrong message. That sends a bad message, whether it's intentional or not. It sends a wrong message. And we've got to do something. And I say this, I do still have hope that we can get through this as a nation and as a profession. I do believe it's going to be a lot of work. It's a struggle every day for me to keep that optimism, but I do still have that optimism, but I am a realist also.
Yeah, guys.
That's real talk. Well, Chief Green, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you're good, LA. It's always good to get your input and your insight, sir. But, Keith and listen, we're getting ready to come up on another break, but we're also going to have another audio clip to play of another incident that involved another young juvenile at a school where he was handcuffed, or she was handcuffed by a police officer, and this officer actually brags about her being the youngest that he has handcuffed and arrested. But we're going to take a break. We're going to listen to this video, and we're going to come back. We're going to get into this conversation. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
We are now seeing the shocking body cam video of an Orlando police officer handcuffing a 6-year-old girl after she kicked a staff member in a temper tantrum at her school.
And the charges were later dropped, but the officer was fired. Let's go to Louie now, who has more now on this heart-wrenching scene.
September 19th, 2019, Orlando police officer Dennis Turner arrives at Lucius and Emma Nixon Academy.
Okay, she's going to have to come with us now.
Okay, Kai, you got to go with them, baby girl.
Stand up.
And he arrests 6-year-old Kaya Roll. Staff members at the school say she punched and kicked some of them. You can see a transport officer who officers say was unaware the proper approval was not obtained, restraining Kaya and leading her through the school as Officer Turner's body cam captures her reaction.
Stop.
Okay, come on. You can tell me what happened in the car, okay?
Despite her cries not to...
I don't want to go to the police car.
You don't want to?
No, please.
You have to.
The transport officer places Kaya in the back seat of a patrol car and takes her to a juvenile justice center near downtown. Turner is seen speaking to school staff whose faces we blurred, who says Kaya makes her his youngest arrest.
She's 8, isn't she? She's 6. Now she has broken the record.
Kaya's grandmother says Kaya suffers from a medical condition and sleep apnea, which causes her temper tantrums.
What do you mean she was arrested?
She told us in September that she should have never been taken into custody. Shortly after her arrest, Orlando's police chief announced he fired Turner for not seeking approval before her arrest. He also approved new policies that require a deputy chief to approve any arrest under the age of 12.
And by the way, that body cam video was not released by the Orlando Police Department. It was released by the attorney for the family who's pursuing this legal matter. Calvin and Nicole, back to you.
Okay, Louis, thank you.
Welcome back to the show, you and the law on the Bassett News Radio Network, the Bassett News Radio Network, WCOM in Chapel Hill and Carrboro. Again, if you missed any part of this broadcast, you can listen to the rebroadcast. Go to our website. You can even make comments on their page about any questions or comments you have, any shows you want to comment on, any show topics. You can do that at the Unilaw page at our website, the Bassett News Radio Network.com. I will be screening calls. If you have a question or comment, you can say yay or nay. You keep listening and what have you. You're not on the air when I screen a call. Just want to let you know real quick, guys, a couple of things, and I'll get out of your hair. My kid, oh, it's going to be hell to pay. You're going to terrorize my kid. Mine's a teen, but and this poor baby is 6 years old, and you handcuffing her? You can't just put her in the car? First of all, it's one thing to even do the arrest, but then you're going to cuff a six-year-old. Again, humanity, that's one thing. And again, why would we be surprised if the bad apples that make it worse for you guys look at us as cattle and animals, then it don't matter if they 6 or 66, it seems. And then there's this brokenness. The cop in the earlier excerpt, he kept the job. The one in this one got fired. So there's no consistency. There's no continuity there. And I know it goes by agencies, which is why, in my opinion, it should be straight across the board. And the one question I do have for you, and someone asked me this, and I'm going to ask you this. You know, the Biden administration has put about, I can't remember, it's hundreds of millions of dollars into prevention rather than policing in these cases, whether it be COVID or not. So instead of you guys having to do the extra work of being the counselor and breaking up domestic violence and everything, they're bringing in these people that may see the signs of medical issues or mental issues. So I want to get you guys' thoughts on that and how effective it would be.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, L.A. Well, I want to go back to the first video that we shared with our listeners. And in that video, it was a black female officer and a white male officer who had been called to the school because the 6-year-old had walked away from the school. They took him back to the school. But what was so disturbing about that, Keith, is the fact that this female officer was screaming for her voice in front of other adults, in front of the child. And so you have to ask yourself, was this lady, was she a mother? Was she a grandmother? Did she have nieces and nephews? And why would the school officials allow this to happen in their building? You know, they are the ones who call the police, and whether they were concerned about this 6-year-old safety. And, you know, Keith, we've talked about this on the show where when you have police officers in school, the term of pipeline to prison has been talked about for decades in our public education. And so, and it's something that we are seeing in our elementary school. But it was very disturbing to see this lady, who could be a mother or grandmother, display the unprofessionalism with this young child, and the fact that she even handcuffs him in the presence of the mother. And I don't think our listeners, that this mother didn't realize the severity of what had happened until this was shared with her, and they released the this body cam footage to the mother. And that's why now you have the mother who is seeking legal actions. And now on the second audio clip that we played, where, again, this is a black male officer who is bragging about that this 6-year-old has broken a record as being the youngest that he has ever arrested. You know, LA and our listeners, I asked myself, why are these individuals even wearing a badge? Because, again, you know, you're dealing with a child, and the traumas that this child is going to face will be for decades to come. And even when whether you're in law enforcement or you're retired, you still don't know that one situation that you had with that juvenile, the long-term mental health impact that is going to be had with that child. And I think this is something that we really need to talk about in the law enforcement community. And, you know, when we talk about, Keith, when we talk about bad cops, bad apples, there's bad black cops and there's bad white cops. But it just really gets under my skin when I see and I hear another, especially a black female, treating a 6-year-old child this way and chastising this child and screaming at this child. And, you know, it just makes you wonder, where is this lady from? Now, you know, L.A., you mentioned in Orlando, the officer there, he was terminated by his agency, but the agency in Maryland County where this other incident took place, that female officer and that male officer, I think they received some disciplinary actions, but they're still on the job. I would not want to see, I would not like to have these two officers working for my agency. I think some people will probably say that's pretty harsh, but I think we need to have officers who understand the role that we have and how we need to carry ourselves. Yeah, there are some bad kids who act out and carry out, but I'm going to go back to, if the school can't handle the situation, why are you calling in the police to deal with a 6-year-old and a 5-year-old kid? That is just we've dealt with it. We're going to continue to deal with it, but I just think it's something that the schools really need to do a better job of dealing with, because we just don't have officers who really know how to deal with children. So, you know, listeners, if you've got a comment about these videos that we share with you, you can go to our Facebook page at You and the Law One, and click on the link to watch the video. But just very disturbing videos where police officers are not treating these children and trying to understand what's going on and what's causing them to have these outbursts. And first of all, making sure that you get a parent there. You know, this officer in Orlando, he handcuffed and took away the six-year-old without the parent even being there. And because so many things can happen, and I've told my officers this all the time, when you put a child in a police car, first of all, you know, at a certain age, you're supposed to be in a booster seat or a car seat. I don't know if this officer had that in the vehicle. It doesn't appear that he did. But anything can happen. An accident can happen, and you're transporting a child under the age of eight somewhere, and something can happen. All those things we don't think about, but those are things that we really need to think about, and why not handle everything at the school? And I have to say this, that when you listen to both of these incidents, one happened in Maryland, one happened in Orlando, not one time do you hear the officers say, can you guys deal with this and not make this a police issue? Yeah, you had one of the kids supposedly kick a teacher or whatever. You're a teacher. You're not being paid to be abused, but you're being paid to do a job. And you should have counselors at the school, or you should have somebody at the school who can deal with these children to where they're not being put back or being introduced into the criminal justice system, because the six-year-old was taken to a juvenile justice system where the charges was later dropped. But, guys, can you understand just the trauma that these kids are dealing with, and the fact that you got these kids are crying that they don't want to be put in a police car, they don't want to be put in handcuffs, but not at one point did the out take away from them being a police officer. Put in front of these are adults.
Chief Humphrey, that the that goes back to the question of, you know, you guys have so much on your plate, especially the good ones like you. You got to be all kinds of mediators and everything. You're dealing with all kinds of stuff. So, again, it goes back to the question of, is this a good thing? Is this something that would work, Chief Humphrey, where instead of they having more officers in these situations, they have more mediators or people who deal with mental illness or child issues, let's call it, or whatever, where they can go, or officers are trained in that matter. That might be even a different step. I mean, I know you're trained, but you can't be a psychologist. Like, you can't be that on the road, dude. I mean, you already got your hands, you know, with the bad with criminals and everything else. So the Biden administration put this money towards this different way of solutions in handling these cases, Chief Humphrey. Is that something that could be long-lasting and positive that'll work in these situations rather than have an officer arresting a five-year-old or a six-year-old?
Sure.
Well, hey, guys, before we get into that, I just noticed that we're coming up on our last break, so we need to take this break, and then we'll come back and we'll pick up that conversation. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
Space. Some regions are vast and empty, other areas we call closets. Fortunately, Kevin from the Container Store has answers.
Right.
Kevin, what gives you the power over space?
I'd say Alpha customizable closets. With free design and Alpha's adjustable shelving and drawers, I can create space in any size closet.
Kevin, master of space and closets.
Or just Kevin. Plus, right now, save 30% on Alpha and installation and earn up to $500 in credit through February 10th.
At the Container Store, where space comes from.
Where is that music coming from?
Welcome back to You and the Law on the Bastion News Radio Network, WCO and the Chapel Hill. Again, the rebroadcast at the Bastion News Radio Network. Their show page is You and the Law. Follow them on Facebook, You and the Law. And, of course, we certainly appreciate you listening this evening as we try to keep it happy. No play on the instrumental. But I didn't mean to interrupt you, Chief Humphrey. You were responding to that question that the came from the audience about, you know, having some different mediators or some different forms of training for people to go in with the mental illness.
Yeah, Alec, those resources are available, and we talk about the CIT training, crisis and intervention training, CIT officers, all that stuff is in existence, man. What we got to get people to understand, you can't teach common sense. Bottom line is, why were you as an adult arrest a 6-year-old child? There's no CIT. That doesn't matter if that guy's had CIT training or not. That's common sense. Why would you do that? Now, do you need that emotional intelligence training? Absolutely. But let me tell you what's happened to law enforcement over the last 25 and 30 years. We come up with all these great ideas. I remember in the 90s, Clinton passed the Weed and Feed Act, COP. That's when community-oriented policing first was introduced as a formalized process. Weed and Feed, going to the communities, paid overtime for officers to be out playing basketball with kids, and you had your neighborhood officers, and that was their focus, to stay in that neighborhood and get to know people and reduce crime and be resources for between the liaison between. That's all great. The funding ran out. Let's talk about the DARE program. The DARE program, that was a program that was basically geared toward helping youngsters, and I believe that was fifth and sixth, seventh grade. It was teach them about the dangers of drugs. That lost funding. See, when that stuff loses funding, it's all great. It's all great when this money's put out there. But what we don't do in law enforcement, we don't focus on ways to sustain those programs. It's like that new car. You're going, you buy that new car, but you're not thinking about the insurance and the maintenance and things long term. You think about, I got a brand new car, I can drive it. Not going to break down, but when it breaks down, that's what's happening in law enforcement. So now we're getting all these new ideas. Everybody's got these new ideas. But the thing about it is, let's grab them, but who are you putting in those programs? How do you sustain those programs? It's great to have these explore programs. It's great to have these mental health professionals going out with the officers. It's great, but can you sustain them? And are you doing it for the right reasons? Are you doing it because it's the right thing to do, or are you doing it because it looks good and you want to check that off on your bucket list? That's the things that happen. We don't have people, you know, our profession has lost its ability or the ability or capability to sustain things that we need. We get them, we don't sustain them. When you start something and you can't finish it, that's when it's detrimental to a community. Yes, these type of programs work. But you got to have the right people in the program. You got to have a formalized program with a mission and a vision, and then you got to be able to sustain it. That's where we fall down in law enforcement. That's where we fall down in federal funding. When it comes to that, we jump on the money. You know, it's just like the hiring more officers, the COPS grant. You know, we get this money to hire 20, 30 new officers. You already know after 3.5 years, you're going to have to sustain that. We take that money up front, and we're going to do that. We're going to do this, and we're going to do this. 3.5 years come. We either can't keep those officers, or we go away from the mission that we hired those officers to do. That's the problem with law enforcement. That's the problem with local law enforcement and federal funding and communities. We don't sustain it. We look at the short term and not the long term.
Well, you're absolutely right, Keith, and I think a lot of people in the community don't realize that when these programs are implemented and there's federal funding from it, that funding doesn't last for very long. And so that is why, you know, I think, you know, one of the questions about what's going on with the Biden administration with funding, there may be some federal funding, but that gives agencies the ability to apply for a grant to utilize those federal dollars, but that funding may not last but a year. It may not last but 2 years. And now what that agency started, if they don't have it in their budget to continue it, then it just goes away.
Every department doesn't get a chunk of that money either. That's very competitive.
It's very competitive. Yeah. It is. As you and I both know, if you're with a smaller agency, if you are lucky to get any of that funding, you're going to really receive a very small percentage of that funding, if any at all. So the majority of those grants go to much major city agencies such as, you know, like New York or Los Angeles or any major city that has a very large police department. Some of those federal dollars are going there, and they're not reaching our small and rural agencies, in which the majority of our law enforcement is made up of small and rural agencies. So that's a whole other conversation to have about the funding mechanism when there's federal dollars coming down to our local law enforcement. But to get back on this topic about the mental state of our kids dealing with law enforcement officers, and the fact that this is not a conversation that the law enforcement community is having as to telling their officers these are things that we should not be doing. And the two videos that we saw, there are hundreds of videos or hundreds of other incidents that have happened where police have handcuffed kids from the ages of 6 all the way up to 10 to 15 years of age. And you have to continue to ask yourself, why do these things continue to happen? Incidents have happened with me where I have just become livid with officers who, when I find out that they put handcuffs on a child, because I'm looking at them and I'm saying, you have a child. Would you want an officer putting handcuffs on your child? And the very first thing they will say, no. Well, why would you do it to somebody else's child? And again, we don't
Virgil, they think that they're solving a problem, and it's all about scared. This is not the days of scared straight. You know, we have to go back and look at, man, there's a bigger picture than this, Virgil, in L.A. You know, we're talking about children and them being traumatized. Let's just think this. You got a little 9-year-old girl walking to the store with her aunt to get some snacks, and she sees a police officer. And there's already tension in Minneapolis regarding previous officer-involved deaths. And she sees a man kneeling on this man's neck. Now, this is a person who has been sworn in to protect the community, okay? This is that person. And she's even saying, get up off of it, and he's ignoring her. That's why people, and it's not going to get any better, because how many kids under the age of 15, or let's just say under the age of 12, saw that, and they continue to see it over and over again because it's on social media? You don't think that's traumatized? You don't think that traumatized people? You don't think that traumatized kids to the point that they don't want to see police officers? You don't think that traumatized kids enough that when they do see a police officer, even if you're trying to go up and talk to them, they're going to run because they don't know? So it's bigger than just, you know, handcuffing someone. You have a nation and a large kids that are tuned into social media and more in tune with what's going on in the world saw a man die at the hands of a police officer. Don't think that that's traumatizing? You don't think that a group of kids saw a police officer shoot a 15-year-old girl. Whether it was justified or not, let's just take the justification out of it, what it was or not. But they saw a 15-year-old girl die in front of them. That is traumatizing. Doesn't mean if it's no matter if it was justified or not. You see this stuff. Kids are seeing this stuff. They're seeing these type of things going on in their communities. They're seeing this stuff on TV. They're seeing this stuff nationally. Of course they're traumatized. Of course they are. They're traumatized because they're afraid, and they should never be afraid of police officers, whether it's on based on what officers have done or based on what their parents have told them. A child should never be afraid of police officers. We should always, a child should always be able to come up to us and ask us for assistance, and we give them guidance. So I just had to get that out there because it's a very, very sensitive topic with me because it upsets me when I just see that you have kids that had to witness that, and that little girl testified that she saw that. And you don't think she's traumatized?
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Keith. And I think, you know, anybody, whether you're a parent or not a parent, you don't have to be a parent to understand the trauma that these young children are dealing with and the long-term impact that those children would have to deal with that. And they may not have the resources to seek to talk to somebody about the things that's going on with them. And as the older they get, Keith, the more of a resistance attitude that they have with police. I'm going to give you an example of something that we talked about several months ago on our show that took place I believe it was in Baltimore, where a group of kids walking home from school, they have to ride public transportation. They got stopped by several police officers. Next thing you know, one of the police officers is putting one of the kids in the back of the car. Now, these kids know their rights. They know that the police can what they can and cannot do. But, Keith, when we talk about our show is called You and the Law, and we are here talking to our listeners and our parents and the youth about what are your rights when you are dealing with law enforcement. But when and so many people have said this to me, Keith, is that you guys talk about what our rights are, but we actually really don't have any rights when we deal with the police because we can't say no. If we say no, then they're saying that we're resisting, and then resisting leads to being thrown down on the ground or thrown down on a car, handcuffed, and being arrested. And which could lead up to the death of an individual. So for everybody who is a police officer that listens to this podcast show, You and the Law, you really need to understand the long-term impact that you and this industry is having on our youth because it's not going to go away, and you wonder when you say something to them, they have an attitude with you, and now you're wondering, well, why you got an attitude with me? I didn't do anything to you. Well, it may not be you. It may have been another officer, but they're just seeing you as the police. There's not a consistency of behavior across America policing. You don't get the same thing in L.A., and you don't get the same thing in North Carolina or New York. There's so much difference, Keith. And I think that's why when police officers wonder, well, you're having an attitude. Well, if these kids don't want to have nothing to say to you, let them walk. Just like, Keith, we talked about the young man in Dallas in Irving, who was walking home in the snow. What happened to him? He did everything he could to avoid having any conversation with the police, but they forced themselves upon him that led to him being arrested. They later dropped the charges, but now you've got a young man who he's going to be dealing with the trauma of having a bad experience with police. So,
but let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, Virgil. Did you think some of that happens with these officers? Because those were younger officers. And do you think sometimes they feel like they just have to do something? Do you think we're training them that way? Do you think we train them
in
the fact that you just can't leave, you can't leave a situation without having a solution? And we're not training them that sometimes you just can't do something. So is it a training thing? Is it a common sense thing? Because the reason I'm asking that just really quick, because I've talked to young officers about that, and their thing is, well, what if we let him go and he gets hit by a car, and then they find out later that we tried to talk to him, we're in trouble. You know, you can't make somebody talk to you, but the mind is there. We got to do something. If we don't do something, it's going to look like we don't care, or we're going to look like we're not doing our job. I'm not making excuses, but I'm just telling you, you got to look at it on both sides.
Yeah, well, and some of it could be the inexperience of the officers, but we also see senior officers who have the same thing. Keith, I just think it just comes down to, and this is my opinion, Keith, I think it comes down to the individual, their background, where they came from.
Absolutely.
And how they value, and I want to use that word again, how they value other people's lives, because we know they would not do their children that way, or they would not do their friends' children that way. But when you don't value another child's life, whether they're black or Latino, Native American, when you look at that person and you don't have any value, then you're just saying, I've got on a uniform, I got on a badge. When I tell you to get off the street and get on the curb, you better do so. And if that kid says, man, forget you, I'm finna walk where I want to walk, guess what? Now all of a sudden, the aggression and the attitude comes in, because it's like, how dare you speak to me that way? Well, at the end of the day, dude, first of all, you're not the kid's daddy. If he wants to, you tell him to get on the sidewalk, get on the sidewalk. At the end of the day, let this young man go, or let this young lady go, but try to build some type of relationship that the next time they see you, it may be much of a more positive encounter, because what they're going to remember is, man, you that asshole dude who I had to deal with before, and man, I don't want to deal with you again. And there's going to be that back and forth. And, Keith, as you know, that back and forth will continue on until something either good happens or something bad happens.
Yeah, this is an ongoing dialogue we got to have, man. But let me just say, what's the most important part of training?
Listening.
What's the most important part?
I would say
continuing to be a student of the profession, no matter what.
Yeah, well, that too.
Level you at.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, hey, Keith, brother, it has been good to have another great show where we're talking with our listeners about important topics that are happening in our community, and we want to encourage our listeners to continue to follow You and the Law. And tune in again next week as we come up with more great topics to talk with you guys about. But tune in to us next Tuesday, and as on the Bachelor News Radio Network. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
All right. Good night, everybody.